lymphatic system.
Remember that our body always has to have a way of dealing with infections. We learned that the function of the white blood cells is to help defend us against any kind of foreign microorganisms. Foreign microorganisms are always going to be around and present. You look at all the different diseases that are out here still today that are very prevalent. You know, people get colds, people get flu, you know, and then there's those kinds of illnesses that are transmitted, you know, like through droplets, like TB, you know, with the mycobacterium, and there's all kinds of different problems that are going to occur. So on page 335, it starts out saying, all of us live in a hostile and dangerous environment. And this refers to, you know, just the way our bodies have to, you know, function with the cells and all the organ systems. Each day we are faced with potentially harmful toxins, disease-causing bacteria, viruses, and even cells from our own bodies that have been transformed into cancerous invaders. Fortunately, we are protected from the staggering variety of differing biological enemies by a remarkable set of defense mechanisms. We refer to this protective safety net as the immune system. Okay, this chapter deals with the lymphatic system and with immunity. The system is characterized by structural components, many of them lymphatic organs, and by a functional group of specialized cells and molecules that protect us from infection and disease. So a lot of times what's going to happen is either you're going to have the white blood cells coming to the site of an infection and then doing their job of engulfing those foreign materials, you know, and then making sure that everything's okay. In other cases, you're going to have an introduction of microorganisms that are going to result in our body developing an immunity to it. Okay, now that's the reason why we go through, from the time we're born, we go through getting what's called immunizations, because immunizations help to safeguard us and they give us an immunity against any type of diseases, you know, by putting within our body antibodies that are going to counteract us from getting kind of different types of illnesses like measles or mumps, you know, or anything like that. Okay, so being vaccinated is very important. On page 336, we go into the lymphatic system. Maintaining the constancy of a fluid around each body cell is possible only if numerous homeostatic mechanisms function effectively together in a controlled and integrated response to changing conditions. So as we learned before in when we studied the circulatory system, and then we studied about the different cells of the blood, you know, that the blood is going to carry all of the ingredients that we need for each body cell to the cell, and there's going to be an exchange through the capillaries, and then they're going to pick up the carbon dioxide and take it back away from the cells. But it has to be in a condition that is known as homeostasis, where everything is kind of in an equilibrium type of a state. It's not going to be offset in any way, but unfortunately, when people get sick, there you have the offset. You know, so part of the immune system is to kind of take care of that and bring it back into a state of normalcy. So we've already learned in Chapter 12 the vital importance that the circulatory system plays. This exchange of substances between blood and tissue fluid, again, it occurs in the capillary beds. Many additional substances that cannot enter or return through the capillary walls, including excess fluid and protein molecules, are returned to the blood as lymph. Lymph is a special fluid formed in the tissue spaces that is transported by way of specialized lymphatic vessels to eventually re-enter the circulatory system. In addition to lymph and the lymphatic vessels, the lymphatic system includes lymph nodes and specialized lymphatic organs such as the thymus and the spleen. Okay. just for general knowledge, right now, which will become more prevalent next semester when we have radiation biology, the blood-borne organs are considered extremely radiosensitive. You know, what radiation biology has done is they've gone through the entire body and they can tell you which cell types, which tissue types respond more prevalently to the effects of radiation and which have more of a radio resistance. In the adult, the nervous system and the muscle systems are very, very, you know, they're radio resistant compared to other systems. But any of the systems involved in the formation of the blood cells are going to be highly radio sensitive, as are the organs like, you know, the spleen, you know, and the thymus.
Kind of shrinks once you get old, right?
Everything shrinks when we get old. Your height goes down and everything within you shrinks. So your memory even shrinks a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody says, well, I saw so-and-so the other day. Oh, who's that? Somebody you knew from years ago and then you don't remember them anymore. You know, so. Okay, how does lymph form? Lymph forms in this way. Blood plasma filters out of the capillaries into the microscopic spaces between tissue cells because of the pressure generated by the pumping action of the heart. There, the liquid is called interstitial fluid or tissue fluid. Much of the interstitial fluid goes back into the blood by the same route it came out, that is, through the capillary membrane. The remainder of the interstitial fluid enters the lymphatic system before it returns to the blood. The fluid, now called lymph, enters a network of tiny blind-ended tubes distributed in the tissue spaces. These tiny vessels, called lymphatic capillaries, permit excess tissue fluid and some other substances, such as dissolved protein molecules, to leave the tissue spaces. The lymphatic system, you know, it's a good system for defense, but at the same time, it's also a system that can spread illness. Lymphatic spread is one of the major metastatic routes, you know, for spreading cancer. Okay. Women who have breast cancer, the reason why breast cancer becomes so prevalent is because of the lymph nodes that are in the axillary part underneath the arm and lateral to the breast. So when women go in for mammography, they really have to have those areas, you know, checked on the film also. But, you know, when cancer spreads around the body, that's called metastasis. And lymphatic spread is one of the major routes of metastatic, you know, cancer spread. So, what I want to do, in the right-hand column, the one area I want you to focus in on, it says, lymph flowing through the lymphatic capillaries next move into successively larger and larger vessels called lymphatic venules and veins, and eventually empties into two terminal vessels called the right lymphatic duct and the thoracic duct, which empty their lymph into the blood in the veins in the neck region. Lymph from about three-fourths of the body eventually drains into the thoracic duct, which is the largest lymphatic vessel in the body. Okay? So the thoracic duct is the largest lymphatic vessel in the body. If you look at the figure on page 337, you can see where a lot of these lymph nodes are located and the lymph ducts. Okay, and you can see the important organs here, like the spleen and the thymus, and their locations. There's even lymph nodes that are just below the mandible, so they use the term submandibular. Okay. Let's look in the section under lymph nodes. As lymph moves from its origin in the tissue spaces toward the thoracic or right lymphatic ducts, and then into the venous blood, it is filtered by moving through lymph nodes. which are located in clusters along the pathway of the lymphatic vessels. So again, if you look on this picture, you can see where we have the different lymph nodes, such as in the knee, where they're called popliteal, and then you have them in the groin area, they're referred to as inguinal. Then you have, like I mentioned before, in the case of breast cancer, you have the axillary lymph node underneath the arm, and then you have cervical lymph node and submandibular nodes. Some of these nodes may be as small as pinhead, and others may be as large as a lima bean. With the exception of comparatively few single nodes, most lymph nodes occur in groups or clusters. So most of the time, they're going to be in groups or clusters, and that's how they occur in certain areas. Figure 13.1 shows the locations of the clusters of the greatest clinical importance. The structure of the lymph nodes makes it possible for them to perform two important functions, defense and white blood cell formation. Okay, so make sure you highlight that. The structure of the lymph nodes makes it possible for them to perform two important functions, defense and white blood cell formation. Okay, let's look at the defense functions. Figure 13.3 shows the structure of a typical lymph node. If you look over there, you can see that it has all these different structures. What you're going to notice is that it's going to have two types of vessels that are attached to the lymph node. Some are called afferent, beginning with the letter A, and some are called efferent, beginning with the letter E. If you notice there, and if you remember from your medical terminology, afferent means that it is going into the lymph node, toward the lymph node or into it, and efferent means it's coming out of the lymph node. So in the section there where it talks about biological function, it says, in the example, there's a small node located next to an infected hair follicle showing filtered bacteria from the lymph. Lymph nodes perform biological filtration, a process in which cells, these, and I remember the term phagocytosis, where the cells engulf, form material, and digest it. So, a process in which cells alter the contents of filtered fluid. Biological filtration of bacteria and other abnormal cells by phagocytosis prevents local infections from spreading. So in a normal situation, when the infection is small enough to where phagocytosis can occur, and then the immune system, the defense system, is going to be able to clean up the foreign material and make sure that it doesn't spread. Okay. So that's not in the normal conditions. Okay, note in figure 13.3 that the lymph enters the node through four afferent lymph vessels. So basically, when I ask you about afferent lymph vessels, those are the vessels through which lymph enters into the node. And then the efferent is where the lymph is going to exit from the node and go away from the node. Okay. Once lymph enters the node, it percolates slowly through the spaces called sinuses that surround nodules found in the outer cortex and the inner medullary areas of the node. Okay, the term sinuses, you probably are familiar. You haven't studied skull yet in positioning. Sinuses are basically just openings. Okay, in our skull, we have the openings in the forehead, behind the nose, underneath the orbits, and these are the sinuses, and they are supposed to typically be filled with air, but in the case of people who have real bad congestion and a cold, they're going to fill with fluid. Okay, so sinus simply just means an opening. So what they're saying here is that this fluid finds these openings in the node, and they are called sinuses. Okay. though it goes through the space called the sinuses that surround the nodules found in the outer cortex and inner medullary areas of the node. In passing through the node, lymph is filtered so that injurious particles such as bacteria and cancer cells are removed. Okay, so this is where the function occurs that takes away these injurious particles from us. And then they are prevented from entering the blood and then circulating all over the body. So as soon as you have a cut, you know, and let's say that you had a dirty instrument and it might have been contaminated depending on what it was in contact with. Maybe you're out gardening and you're using a little shovel, you know, and then you're trying to hammer some stake in and it hits your skin, makes a cut there and the shovel had dirt on it. Well, this is the process that's going to take place. So all those foreign particles that get in there, then, you know, the blood is going to do its job. Okay. Lymph, then, is going to exit from the node through a single efferent lymph vessel. So where there are four afferent vessels, there's only going to be one efferent vessel that leaves. So you can see that there's one arrow for the efferent vessel going out, but there are four for the afferent vessels going in. So four in and one out. Clusters of lymph nodes allow a very effective biological filtration of lymph flowing through the specific body area. Figure 13.4, if you look on page 340, this is an x-ray study known as lymphangiography. In a lymphangiogram, they can inject contrasted media into the soft tissues, and this contrast media is going to accumulate in the lymph vessels and the lymph nodes, and then they're going to take a series of radiographs starting with the lower pelvic area. Okay, and so this way they can see the lymph, and if there's going to be any complications, they can see that on the x-ray. Dye material was injected into the soft tissues below the area visualized in the x-ray. Note the presence of lymph in the vessels and the nodes of the inguinal and pelvic regions. A knowledge of lymph node location and function is important in clinical medicine. A surgeon uses knowledge of lymph node function when removing lymph nodes under the arms and in other areas during an operation for breast cancer. These nodes may contain cancer cells filtered out of the lymph drained from the breast. Cancer of the breast is one of the most common forms of this disease in women. Unfortunately, cancer cells from a single tumorous growth in the breast often spread to other areas of the body through the lymphatic system. Okay. Next semester, you will have a course in pathology. And in pathology, it will cover, you know, how cancer spreads throughout the body and will go over each body system again, you know. So, let's go over a couple of the organs and structures which, you know, help with this system. The first one being the thymus. The thymus is a small lymphoid tissue organ located in the mediastinum. Mediastinum is the central area between the lungs, okay, extending upward in the midline of the neck. So it's going to be in the superior aspect of the mediastinum. Okay. It is composed of lymphocytes in a unique epithelial tissue framework. The thymus is largest at puberty, and even then weighs only about 35 or 40 grams, a little more than an ounce. Although small in size, the thymus plays a central and critical role in the body's vital immunity mechanism. First, it is a source of lymphocytes before birth and is then especially important in the maturation or development of specialized lymphocytes that then leave the thymus and circulate to the spleen, the tonsils, lymph nodes, and other lymphatic tissues. These T lymphocytes or T cells are critical to the functioning of the immune system and are discussed later. They develop under the influence of hormones secreted by the thymus, known as thymocins. Okay, let's move over to tonsils on page 340. And you all probably know about tonsils, and maybe a good number of you have had them removed. Masses of lymphoid tissue called tonsils are located in a protective ring under the mucous membranes in the mouth and the back of the throat. They help protect against bacteria that may invade tissues in the area around the opening between the nasal and the oral cavities. The palatine tonsils are located on each side of the throat. The pharyngeal tonsils, also known as adenoids, when they become swollen, are near the posterior opening of the nasal cavity. And a third type of tonsil, called the lingual tonsil, is near the base of the tongue. The tonsils serve as the first line of defense from the exterior and, as such, are subject to chronic infection. When you think of how much bacteria goes in to our body just through the mouth itself, look everywhere we go, you know, and there's all kinds of particles, you know, that people breathe in. And so, of course, the tonsils, their job is to help, you know, the immune system, but they can be infected so badly themselves that, you know, they have to be removed. Okay? So it says in rare cases they may be removed surgically if antibiotic therapy is not successful or swelling impairs breathing. I don't even know how much tonsillectomies are performed anymore. When I was a kid, it seemed like everybody had them done. Yeah. Almost everybody you knew. But they
stopped doing that. It's just only if they have to.
It might be that medicative therapy, you know, has helped them. You know, I still have mine in, you know. You know, back then, one of the things about medicine, you know, when doctors always, you know, didn't understand what was going on, they always did certain procedures because that was what they did. You know, if somebody has a sore throat or they get chronic infections, they help those tonsils, you know. And it's just like the other procedures too, you know, like one study indicated that women who cannot give birth naturally, you know, and they have a C-section. Some doctors routinely did them. They found every reason in the book to do a C-section.
Yep.
You know, and now they're, the pendulum is swinging the other way, and they're really looking, you know, at a different situation.
Okay.
What was that?
Oh my God!
Okay, let's look at the, on page 341, we have a diagram that shows the location of the tonsils. Okay, look at 341, a diagram of the tonsils. You can see how they're located, actually, all around the mouth. So, if they're not doing that many anymore, then maybe, you know, these people are going to have less, you know, problems. You know, I wonder if there's any correlated studies that are being done to indicate that by people having them left in, you know, they don't get a lot of coughs or colds or sore throats or stuff. Let's look at the spleen. The spleen is the largest lymphoid organ in the body. It is located high in the upper left quadrant of the abdomen, lateral to the stomach. Oftentimes, depending on the technique you use in radiography, you can see the spleen a little bit lined up. Let me see how much your knowledge of techniques and x-ray is. What KV level is needed to see contrast between structures most readily?
Low KV.
Okay. The lower the KV, the greater is the contrast. Okay. Now, when you get into the section on mammography, what you'll find out is that the breast tissue is pretty much the same in the entire breast. One area doesn't stand out in its tissue density compared to other areas, and the KB level in mammography is going to be from like 20 to 30 for that reason, because at that very low KB, you're going to enhance any tissue differentiation, which is what you want to see. Now, when it comes to doing an x-ray of the abdomen, a lot of it depends on the radiography department where you work. Some radiologists want a higher KB, higher KB, more penetrability, okay? But lower KB gives you more contrast. But remember, every time there's an advantage in x-ray, there's a disadvantage from somewhere else. So if your KB is low and you still need sufficient density, guess what has to go up? MAS. And MAS is the enemy to cell safety, because the greater the quantity of photons in the beam, then the more you're going to have the probability of a photoelectric effect occurring, and then that means you're going to have cell damage. You know, when you kick out that outer shell electron or that inner shell electron, and another electron jumps in to take its place, and then you get, characteristic radiation, and stuff like that. But in order to see critical organs in the body, on a good KUB, when you do a good KUB, you want to see the kidneys, the ureters, and the bladder on a general x-ray. So a lot of places where I work, when we did IVPs, they said, well, I want the KB low. Some radiologists would tell them, I want the KB low, and then whatever KB you use on the skeletal, then use that same KB even when you put in the contrast media. So oftentimes you can see the liver shadow, and you can see the shadow of the spleen on there. Okay, what else does the spleen do? Although the spleen is protected by the lower ribs, it can be injured by abdominal trauma. People that have blunt abdominal trauma, if they're in an auto accident and they're pushed forward against the steering wheel, it'll push into the rib cage. It can crack the ribs, but it can also put so much pressure on the internal organs that they have to check that. If there's going to be any kind of hemorrhage from the spleen, it could result in it having to be removed. Whenever you take an organ out, the term is called ectomy. In this case, it would be splenectomy. Okay, so that's what they're saying there. If it's damaged and it's to such a degree, they have to take it out. Now, these days, what you'll find out, you hear a lot of older x-ray techs talk, and routine radiography was always the mainstay. But these days, CT. Everything goes through CT. CT is one of the best tools to image the structures inside of the body, from the kidneys, the spleen, and any of them, and assess what's going on with them. However, if the spleen stays in, after entering the spleen, blood flows through the dense pulp-like accumulations of lymphocytes. As blood flows through the pulp, the spleen removes by filtration and phagocytosis many bacteria and other foreign substances, destroys worn-out red blood cells, and salvages the iron found in hemoglobin for future use, and serves as a reservoir for blood that can be returned to the circulatory system when needed. So these are very important functions. It can act as a storage unit for excess blood. It can take care of the worn-out red blood cells. It can take out the foreign material and continue the job of, phagocytosis and everything like that. So that's really good. So you kind of wonder, if they ever do a splenectomy, what does the body do to make up for the loss of such an organ as the spleen? But I guess people live without it.
The liver works overtime?
Yeah, in some cases, when one organ is taken out, another one can kick into, like, overtime, and do the job. But then again, to MDs especially, then all of a sudden, it kicks into their mind, well, what medications can I give these people now to help them with all of this stuff? So, okay, I don't want to go into the second half of the chapter until next week. So you guys can take a break and then come back and use the remaining time to either study this, or if you have a test in another class coming up this week, you can use that as time to study that.